You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot runner.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 5:30's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 5:38, and with me in the 5:38 studio, Kate Fagan, columnist for ESPNW.
Hi, Kate.
Good to have you with us, as
always.
Good
to be here.
And of course, Neil Payne.
Neil, hey, Chad.
Sports writer for 5:38. Good to have you as well. Guys, today's show, we're talking about tennis for the first time ever.
Yep.
It's an inaugural sport. I think we're running out of sports to talk about for the first time. On Hot Takedown, curling.
I'm holding out for curling.
Yeah. What else? High lie?
Yeah.
What else is on your guys' bucket list for Hot Takedown?
Synchronized swimming.
Ooh.
There's a lot of stats around that.
This may be the most me sentence I'll ever utter, but I saw a great New Yorker cartoon about synchronized swimming recently. I'll show it to you later.
That's going
to
play great on radio.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Today, we're going to talk about tennis with Carl Bialik, 538's Carl Bialik, to talk about the French Open and Rafael Nadal. And then second segment, we're going to bring in another 538 guest, Ruben Fischerbaum, who has somehow shrunk down more than 60 years of NBA history into one incredible chart. And we'll talk about what that perhaps has to teach us about the game. And then finally, with LeBron James just one game away from the finals, James Harden on the cusp of being eliminated from the playoffs altogether, we'll ponder whether stars matter, both in the NBA and every other sport. And sort of what analytics might have to tell us that might be different than the normal sports narratives around that. And then, of course, Allison McCann will be here for Significant Digits. But first, let us go to France, where the French Open has started in Paris. And that means it's clay court season. And that means it's Rafael Nadal season, or at least it used to be. Nadal seems to be on the ropes. To make sense of all that, let's bring in 538's Carl Bialik, who perhaps loves tennis even more than Nate Silver loves hockey. Carl, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, or there, or you know what I mean?
Somewhere in between, in the interdimensional space. So
in the wires.
Yes. So, Carl, Nadal has looked wobbly on clay this season. He's gone 17-5 on the surface this year, as you wrote for 538 late last week. That's far worse than usual, and that's caused folks to wonder if he's done or if he's on the real decline. And here's a clip from an ESPN French Open preview talking about that.
Rafael Nadal has won an astonishing 66 of 67 career matches at Roland Garros, the best record ever by any player at a Grand Slam venue. But that exquisite mastery on the soft, celebrated red clay seems very much at risk. The very qualities that carried the muscular Spaniard to such great heights, uncommon power and unnatural perseverance, now work against him as he ages ungracefully past middle age for an elite player.
So, Carl, is Nadal's exquisite mastery on that soft, celebrated red clay really over?
Well, the nice thing he has for him is his mastery had an incredibly high margin. So even if he's not as great as he once was, he still might be the master. He could win without winning by as much, and he could still win the tournament. We're not going to find out probably for about another week. So a week from tomorrow, if all goes as everyone expects, he'll play number one Novak Djokovic. Neither of them is probably going to have much trouble getting to that match. The first week of slams is often a lot of blowouts on the big courts with the best players playing kind of nobodies, or at least people you've never heard of. But from what it looks like, Djokovic should be the favorite in that match. And if they really do meet, then most likely Nadal's mastery is going to be over, at least for this year.
And Carl, in the writing that you did for the site, you created this this metric dominance ratio, and it showed that Nadal was 80% of the player he used to be on clay. And is that because of what has happened this year? And do we know perhaps what is happening to his body or to his game that might be leading to that decline?
Yeah, I was looking at breaking down winning a tennis match into its building blocks. And to win, you've got to win more points when your opponent's serving than you let your opponent win when you're serving. And if you can do that consistently, you're going to win most sets and matches. Nadal used to do that in dominant fashion on clay, and he just hasn't this year, even though he hasn't been playing the best players. So, yeah, based on that, I think he's declined. That's just what the numbers say. And, you know, a lot of readers said, well, what's accounting for it? And you can't watch a match of his and say immediately, well, he's not serving as hard, he's not moving as well. It seems most likely it's just what happens to a lot of athletes when they age. It's a little bit of a decline in just about everything. It's kind of imperceptible point by point, maybe even in a given match when he's dominating players, but it seems like over the course of 22 matches, we're picking up a definite trend, and that's that he's just not the Rafael Nadal of old.
He's an old
Rafael Nadal.
In baseball, I know at this point in the season, there's a whole slew of articles, especially at the sabermetric type of sites that I tend to read, saying, oh, it's a small sample size if someone is having sort of a rough start to the season, or there may be just bad luck to a certain degree involved. But I also know that tennis is a sport where luck plays a lot less of a role than it does in baseball. So do you think that this is sort of a case of him having bad luck, or has he really declined to the level that we're seeing so far?
Yeah, I think if you just look at his one loss record, you've got to say there's some bad luck, because he's lost some really close matches where, you know, he dominated one set and then lost two close ones, but really outplayed his opponent overall. But the study I was doing last week was trying to take into account all of that. And you're right, this is now a big sample size relative to baseball, in that a given match could have 100, 200 points. So even if he's only played 22 and now 23 today because he won his first round match here, we're talking about thousands and thousands of points. And each point has, you know, 5, 10, 20 shots. So there's a lot of data even in one match. And he's now played 23, and he just doesn't look like the best player in the world on clay anymore.
Now, I know with Nadal, having watched him and the narrative around him being that in a lot of ways he comes back at the end, right? And it's hard to break his confidence because so frequently he'll be down and then come back. What have you seen just in the eye test and anecdotally about where his confidence seems to be at this point, and whether that, if he does win at the French Open, right, does that turn this around for him? Does it seem like it's just something that he could snag back as quickly as winning this tournament this week?
I think absolutely. I mean, in tennis, not all tournaments are created equal or anywhere near it. So even though diehards like me might care about the previous matches this season, for most fans and most historians, the only thing that's going to matter about how he does this year on clay is how he does these next 2 weeks in Paris. So if he does get confident, and, you know, you mentioned how he can just snag the result at the end. He hasn't done that this year. His confidence hasn't been high, and that's been true on clay and elsewhere, that he's just looked like he was going to do what he's always done and win the match in the end, and then he hasn't, or at least he hasn't nearly as often as he used to. But I think kind of the ultimate way of snagging victory from the jaws of defeat this year would be to win this tournament, and then that kind of makes the rest of the clay season just seem like a build-up to his eventual triumph.
But hanging over all this is age, because the guy's getting older and older. I mean, that tends to be what happens to every athlete. But it seems as though the age of tennis play, of the top level of tennis players, has been getting older than when it was when I was growing up, where these phenoms would come in and get their reps, and by the age of 19 or 20, they'd be the best in the world, and then maybe by 25 or 26 they wouldn't be because some phenom had already come in and replaced them. Has the tour been getting older on both sides, the men's and women's sides, like it seems to me?
Yeah, it definitely has. I want to point out that the clip you played from ESPN mentions that Nadal's game in particular seems to make him more vulnerable to aging. He also started younger, so he has more miles, which is kind of what people say about Kobe Bryant. And, you know, he plays a very pounding style, and he also has some knee problems. So he might be the exception, but then again, he's still one of the very best players in the world, and he's almost 29. In fact, if he plays Djokovic next Wednesday, which is what people expect, he'll be playing him on his 29th birthday. And, you know, a lot of the best players had retired by 29, let alone no longer been the very best. But, I mean, now we're seeing there's no one, I was looking this up just before, there's no one under age 23 on the men's side in the top 25. You know, all of the so-called big four, which is Nadal plus Federer, Djokovic, and Murray, they're all at least 28. David Ferrer is another one of the favorites in the tournament. He's 33. Tomas Berdych just reached a career high. He's 29. So, I mean, we're seeing these late 20s, 30s guys. And on the women's side, it's not as extreme, but the median age in the top 20 is almost 27 years old. And, you know, as you said, back in the day, that would be towards the end of the career. Michael Chang won this tournament, the French Open, when he was 17 years old. Chris Evert won her first French Open when she was 19. And now teenagers are barely even making it into these tournaments.
Now, what do you think accounts for that? Do you think that the previous generation or the generation that right now is sort of getting old by traditional standards was just that good that even if they've lost a little bit, they're able to dominate? Or do you think that there's something lacking about the next generation of prospects that are coming up that they just can't contend with some of the good players from the previous generation?
It's a great question, and I've tried to look into it and answer it, and I just have a few ideas. I think certainly on the men's side, there's a generational effect. The four guys at the top and a few of the other players in their cohort just are so much better than the ones in their mid-20s. That generation, some people call them the lost boys. I mean, they're not quite that bad, but none of them have really won a slam or made any noise, gotten anywhere near number one. On the women's side, it's more simple. Serena Williams, she's 33, and she's still number one by far, and women who have come up behind her have tried to contend and occasionally won here and there, but she's still dominant. So that describes what's going on at the top. But then if you go below, like to number 20 or 50 or 100 in the world among the men and the women, you're still seeing players in their late 20s, early 30s, who are playing their very best tennis right now. So, you know, one theory is that it's just a more demanding sport physically now, that younger players don't have the strength and, you know, the bone mass to be able to deal with things like high, heavy topspin balls that they have to hit up at their shoulders even when they're leaping in the air. It's just a much more physically demanding sport. So that's one theory. I think it's also just the sport keeps getting better, and so it's taking longer for players to learn how to make decisions in every possible moment, in every situation, a ball coming at them at a certain angle. You know, you hear about athletes creating patterns that they've seen and they've processed and they figured out how to optimize for. And there's so many different patterns in a tennis point. And the longer you play, the more unconsciously you can just make the right decision at every moment. And I think that has something to do with it, because you'll see players who can't articulate why they're doing something tactically, but are so good at making decisions. And the more you play, the better you are at that. There really isn't one clear answer.
Mm-hmm. And Carl, how much value would you put into like the advancement of technology, whether it's knowledge in terms of a lot of these players as they've gotten older, they have more access to sometimes like nutrition, hydration, different technologies in that area, as well as the wealth of knowledge that comes from the focus that people have put on.
Or the rackets and the shoes and whatever.
All other, of it. Yeah. As well as like here being able to now kind of break down how you play in a very specific way, and here's what works for you. Do you think that plays into the longevity of some of these athletes as opposed to maybe what tennis players in the 60s and 70s and early 80s had access to?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, at any point in a match, you can call out a trainer, you can get access to trainers between matches. The tours are doing much more to help players in between tournaments and in between matches to stay healthy, and there's just much more knowledge shared between players and, you know, between agents who coordinate all these things among multiple players. So I think it is a much healthier sport. People are eating better, people are training better. There's a lot of talk about injuries, because when you have hundreds of pros going around the world all the time, some are going to be injured. But I think in general, just being able to stay healthy for longer is meaning that people who used to retire in their mid-20s are able to actually keep competing into their mid-30s.
Okay, so Carl, we have to leave it there because we're running out of time. In another future Hot Take Down, we'll definitely have you come on and talk about sort of where analytics are at within tennis, because I think that somewhat applies to what Kate was saying, which is sort of our players studying their own shot charts or Hawkeye scatter shots or whatever else or not. But we have to leave it there for now. So, Carl, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Bialik is a senior writer at 538. You can read all of his stuff on tennis and everything else at 538.com. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the feeling? You're sitting there looking at all the people who are at the same game as you. Neil Payne's two seats over from me, and he's got his Phillies hat on. It's just so obnoxious. Not just the Phillies hat, but not knowing how much he paid for that ticket. It's the kind of doubt that can gnaw at somebody. It's gnawed at me. SeatGeek can help with that. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online, and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week, you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code in the settings before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this spring. Let me read you a sample of some hot takes over the past week that I just found lying around on the internet. Bill Russell's Celtics were great. Tim Duncan's Spurs have been even greater. The 1990s Bulls are the best there ever was. The 60s Celtics don't get any respect. Those aren't just hot takes. Those are headlines at 538, and we had data to prove that those headlines were right. For the past month, Ruben Fischerbaum and Nate Silver have been busy creating what is the interactive chart to end all NBA interactive charts. Ruben Fischerbaum is with us now. Hi, Ruben.
Hey, Chad.
I should say Ruben's a visual journalist with 538. So, Ruben, what exactly did you guys do for listeners who haven't seen this complete history of the NBA chart?
Sure. So ELO ratings are a type of measure that we've used for the NFL in the past. Just a simple little team ranking based on each of their game results and how much they won by, who they played, whether they're playing home or away. So a team can kind of accrue these ELO rating points where they can lose them depending on how they do.
And that makes a power ranking, basically.
Exactly. So like a 1,500 team would be average. And then if you have a team like 1,800 rating, that's an exceptionally good team. That's Jordan Bulls. So what we did is we took these ratings, which we calculated all the way back to 1946, and put them all on this interactive line chart. So you can select a team and see how it's gone up and down over the course of its history.
So what I'm looking at here is sort of, it's like a, it almost looks like a heartbeat monitor or something like that. And in the background, there's a huge number of gray lines, and then one team is pulled out and highlighted in front of all the others. And so people can actually look at where their favorite team or a team they're really interested in is where they fall and how the history of their franchise has gone up and down.
That's exactly right. So if you go to the Bulls, then you'll see in the beginning of their franchise, they were fine. They go above the average line and below, but they're always pretty close to it. Right around the 90s, they get someone, Jordan, and all of a sudden they're higher than the line has ever been before. And then they drop, Jordan retires, and then they shoot right back up, even higher than that. They were the best team ever for two different streaks. Then Jordan leaves again, and it's just this incredible plummet to quickly becoming one of the worst teams in the entire league. So you can just see those sort of ups and downs and how they relate to the other teams in the NBA.
Okay, so two things. One, the Knicks. I looked at their chart. They were the worst team, basically. The last time they peaked in ELO was 1969.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Can you, even though I know the answer to this, can you please share for our listeners how that compares to every other NBA team in terms of when their highest ELO was in relationship to where we stand now in 2015?
Yeah, so no other active team had an ELO peak earlier than the Knicks.
Which sounds like it should be a good thing for these Knicks.
I mean, it was good for those.
Because there was a peak at some point.
Right.
But it has to be
it's
a
not
peak.
All valid.
I got to say, it's not quite as bad as it sounds. The 90s Knicks, also a great team, were very, very close. They came within a couple points of the 69 Knicks. But that's it. And today's Knicks,
so it has, it's not going to make it downhill since 69. It's that it's been like a weird little roller coaster ride that's never gotten to the same height.
Right, downhill and then up a slightly shorter hill, and then downhill and then up a shorter hill, over and over again. And at the bottom of the hill right now, we'll see how it goes.
But their company they're keeping there is the Milwaukee Bucks, or various cities for the Bucks. But 1971 was when their ELO peaked, and then the Nets in 75. So that's the kind of company we're talking about my New York Knicks are keeping. That's all I'm saying.
Are you surprised? I feel like that matches up pretty well with what we think of the Knicks, which is that they've been I guess in the 90s with the Starks era. Knicks that maybe we thought maybe they'd be.
Of course I wasn't surprised. I guess I just don't like when things are represented in like tangible form for me to look at in a painful
damn
way.
Data. Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing that I wanted to ask you about was a lot of people we'll talk about how, like, at least in the 1980s, there before expansion and the star heavy and the competition with Magic and Larry, and like that was when the NBA was at its best. And then when Michael Jordan's teams, at least in this graph, dominate in the 90s, there's expansion teams. Can you at least explain how you take into account the competition level as much as you can within the league at that time?
Yeah, so I would say that expansion kind of cuts both ways. On one hand, you can make the argument that the talent is being spread a little thin. The best teams are not as good. On the other hand, being the best team out of 30 teams is just harder to do than being the best team out of 20 teams. And so the ELO does account for the quality of the opponent. It's the amount of ELO that's available to kind of divvy up among the teams goes up as the expansion increases, which does favor more recent teams. But I think that just because there were fewer teams in the 80s, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's more impressive to be on top then.
Now, we talked about the 96 Bulls. They're number one all-time in ELO. What were some of the other teams that you guys found as ranking among the best of all time in NBA history?
Yeah, so right behind the 96 Bulls would be either the 97 or the 95 Bulls.
Right. More Bulls. Bulls behind Bulls.
More Bulls.
And so we've had a couple flips as the postseason's progressed. Right now, the third best team would be Larry Bird's 85-86 Celtics, mm-hmm. followed by the current Golden State Warriors.
Now, that's really interesting. Certainly, the 86 Celtics are one of those teams that people talk about, the 96 Bulls and the 97 Bulls. This Warriors team you're saying right now is in that conversation. Should they win the title, they'll be in there? Or right now, as of like this afternoon, they are in that top five all time?
So ELO rating doesn't really care about titles.
Mm-hmm.
It cares about them in that you get more points because you're beating a good team, and mm-hmm. the other team you're playing in the title is probably going to be good, but it doesn't know it's a championship. As of right now, the Golden State Warriors have an ELO rating that puts them in the same league, a little bit below the Jordan era Bulls and Larry Bird Celtics.
So if they were to, we're recording this when the Warriors are up 3-1 against the Rockets. If they were to lose the next three games, that would drop their ELO rating because they lost to a good team, presumably.
It would.
So, but if they won the championship, then we don't know quite how high they would go, but we know that they would just go higher.
If you win a game,
yeah,
you can only go up.
Got it.
And so if the Warriors
even if you're playing
close this out and win the title, so for example, when they beat the Rockets 99-98, they went up a single point, but they still went up. And there's no way they would go down by winning a title at this point unless there's some weird situation where they win exactly as many games as they need to and all their losses they lose by 40 points or something.
Were you surprised when the results came back and the Golden State Warriors were at number four?
I was surprised. They're a great team. People know they're a great team, but to see them that high on the list was a little surprising. I think it's if they do win the title, I think it would be a lot easier to look back on this season in retrospect and see how great they were. But there were so many great teams this year. The Clippers and Spurs this season were also extremely high. The West was just incredible to watch. That you could sort of get lost how historical what the Warriors put together this year maybe was.
So do we know about the best teams that never won a title or the worst teams that did win a title?
So we definitely know about the best teams that didn't win a title. Number one on that list would be LeBron James's final original year in Cleveland, followed by the Utah Jazz losing in the finals to the Bulls,
with Malone.
Followed by the Utah Jazz again losing in the finals to Malone. Those two Jazz teams would both rate among the 15 best teams of all time.
So the reputation that Malone and Stockton really got stymied by the Jordan era mm-hmm. is accurate.
You can be the 15th best team all time. Maybe you run into the best team all time. It happens. Unlucky for them. As for the worst teams to ever win a title, so the way the ELO calculates, this is more of a methodological thing. All teams start out at a certain level, and then as they progress, then they gain or lose. So the worst teams to ever win are teams to win in 1946 and 1947. That would get trashed today, but they're champions.
One more note from some of the headlines that Chad brought up. Seems like the Celtics, specifically the Bill Russell era Celtics, have been something of a discussion point with regard to the ELO ratings. Specifically, they don't rank as high as probably a lot of basketball aficionados would rank them. Why is that, do you think? And does it speak more to ELO or just something about the nature of the game back then that it was easier to win and be dominant?
Well, I'd hope the answer is both. So the two things that are happening there are, first of all, there were a lot less teams, and some of them were very bad. And so
the Floridians?
They wouldn't have been playing the Floridians. Oh. But so the Celtics only get so much credit for kind of beating up on this small amount of not great competition.
10-team league back then, I believe?
I think that's right. The second thing is that, like I said, ELO doesn't know what a championship is. It's just another game. And those Celtics had this incredible play, these incredible playoff runs, dominance that no one else has ever seen. The regular seasons, if you look at them, are very, very good, but you wouldn't read through the regular seasons and think this is a team that won 11 of 13 titles. They were just really good. And those games, they're weighted a little bit less by how we calculate ELO, but they still count for a lot.
Ruben, thanks for coming on. Listeners can play around with this on 538.com. Remind me, how many games are shrunk into this?
We have a little over 63,000 games.
63,000 games in one chart. Jody is texting me from the producer studio, 63,144 games to be exact. It's really incredible to watch, and it seems like the perfect bar companion. That any debate that you get into with a friend at the bar about, you know, who's better than who or which team's better than which, we finally have a quantified answer.
Yep, done. It's over.
Yeah. Whip out your ELO rating.
No need for bars.
No cooler move at a bar than whipping out an ELO rating. Ruben, thanks a lot for coming on.
Of course, thank you for having me.
And again, you can see this interactive chart at 538.com. So when the Clippers lost in the playoffs earlier this month, Chris Paul went down with them. It was Paul's seventh trip to the playoffs in the last 8 years, and it was his seventh trip home without a ring. And it got us pondering that old question that yakkers and analytics types have tried to figure out for a long time: do stars matter? And do they matter in some sports more than others? Because I think you can't just talk about the NBA because the mechanics of each sport is different. So, Neil, you've done too much research to respond to this question.
Far too much.
The cone of silence has descended. Mm-hmm. Kate, of the four major sports, and yes, hockey fans, we're including hockey. Sorry, soccer fans, we are not including soccer. Where would you rank them as far as where stars matter the most?
Right. Okay. So this is just off the top of my head or in the last 90 seconds thinking about this. Number one, and I believe Neil will agree with this, is the NBA. Now, my two and three, cone of silence, my two and three is where I want to flip-flop back and forth. Right now I have in my latest scribblings here MLB and then NHL. Just because NHL, when your stars are only on the ice like a third of the time. And in baseball,
interesting.
Of course, it's more different to measure, but you can, if you have a great player like Mike Trout, and the impact on his game, on the game, feels like it could be more extreme than like Ovechkin.
So you're sort of talking about usage rate in a way, which is like how many chances do they have to affect the game that is playing out?
And then when they have those chances, how much does it affect the game?
Right.
As opposed to, well, NBA highest, but still, like, one play, not as much of an impact as, like, Mike Trout hitting a home run. All right, so I'm going to stick with that. NBA, MLB, NHL, and then the NFL. And that's just, I could be completely wrong on the NFL, but my gut feeling is because of numbers, number of players, because you're not, most players aren't playing defense, they're only playing offense, or they're only playing defense and not offense, the amount of impact you can have on the game is severely limited. And then when you're in the game, it's so dependent on all of these other variables that your one shining star is not going to be as bright.
I've got the NFL first, Kate.
No, you don't.
I do. And
no,
here's
you don't.
Why.
Well, you're
stars,
wrong. You're wrong.
Stars in the NFL are quarterbacks. Running backs, sort of, fine. Wide receivers, sort of, fine. The stars
offensive
of the NFL.
Offensive linemen.
Yeah.
Left guard,
right guard.
Neil, did you lift the cone? I didn't think that you did. So, but here's my point. Quarterbacks, in my mind, starting hypothesis, have more ability to impact a game than any other athlete in any other sport, is what I'd argue. So quarterbacks would matter more in the NFL. That's my starting hypothesis. Then basketball, then hockey, then baseball. Baseball because there's just not much that you're involved in any given play, as you said earlier. So, Kate, are you ready to lift the cone, or do you want to continue our conversation?
When you say the NFL, I guess I wasn't thinking about it as only quarterbacks. I was thinking more as like I look at you now. You're like,
you're welcome to think whatever.
I want to hear what Neil thinks.
So you're ready to lift the cup.
I want to just acknowledge that I wasn't thinking just quarterbacks about the NFL. I was thinking about every best player's ability to impact the game.
Okay.
Don't look at me, Neil.
We're hoisting.
Your take now that you know that quarterbacks are
the sole definition.
I'm not arguing. This is the gospel. I'm just saying.
We were talking a couple weeks ago about Tom Brady missing four games and that value versus a draft pick, and we were talking about how the draft pick was more valuable than Tom Brady across missing four games. So
she makes a good point.
I was thinking about that. So I'm going to keep. I'm going to keep my 1 through 4.
You're staying
ranking.
True.
Yep.
Good.
So it may come as a surprise to you guys that I did a little number crunching on this. So what I looked at, I did not do this for football. So it should bear mentioning that we really did kind of a look at quarterbacks, but we didn't do it as rigorously as the rest of the sports. But we'll talk about football probably at the end. Basketball came out as easily the sport in which the stars mattered the most. And just doing a little naive calculation where we looked at players' impact in advanced stats and sort of like if you put a player on a team with average teammates and you did that over the course of his whole career and sort of shook things up a bit by randomizing them, looking at the odds that the player would win at least one championship sort of due to his own goodness, not due to any of the other circumstances around him. And for a player like LeBron James or Michael Jordan, who statistically are basically the best players ever, or at least since the merger, which was in the 70s and the Floridians disappeared when that happened, a player of that caliber would go without a championship over the course of a full career, like 15, 17, 20 years, only about 5 to 10% of the time.
So, all right. So you ran how many simulations?
500 per player. Okay. And I did this for a variety of different player types that I'll talk about.
So in 19 of 20 simulations, a player of LeBron and Michael Jordan's caliber win at least one championship.
Yeah, for their career.
Given totally average random teammates.
Right, okay.
So Scottie Pippen
doesn't exist. So there's
no
GM that's putting the right pieces there.
Well, I tried to build that into the simulation a little bit, so I didn't give them strictly average teammates every single season of this career. I had it so that on average they would come out with very vanilla teammates, but some careers out of like LeBron's 500 careers, sometimes he would have like all-stars to play with and he would win 8 rings, and sometimes he would have nothing to work with and he would win 1 and on rare occasions 0 rings. But I tried to set it up as close as I could to the way that careers really work, up to and including if you get a good set of teammates in one of your seasons, it'll carry over from the season before and it'll carry over into the season afterwards. So in that run of the simulation, you'll probably be more inclined to win more championships.
So that suggests that stars win in the NBA, but it doesn't necessarily say that stars matter, because to know that, we have to know what happens when you're not as good as LeBron and MJ. So did you run it for players that weren't quite at that caliber?
I did. So we talked about Chris Paul, and he is in that level, still Hall of Fame caliber player in my opinion, and in the opinion of the stats, big coincidence there, that a player of Chris Paul's caliber would go his entire career without a championship about 15% of the time. And we're like halfway through his career. We're not by no means, you know, ready to make this statement that he'll never win a championship, although I'm sure people have espoused that over the last couple weeks after the Clippers melted down. But a player of his caliber should win at least one championship about 85% of the time. But then when you go down the list, you have like James Harden, about 30% of the time, he won't win a championship for the entirety of his career. Kobe Bryant, also about a third of the time, he'll go his entire career without a championship.
So Kobe definitely isn't better than MJ in this.
According to the numbers, which we've written about in the past, that you know LeBron and Michael Jordan are on a different level statistically than Kobe Bryant. He's in that group with Chris Paul, with James Harden type of players. And then when you get to Blake Griffin, who I did sort of as an all-star, but certainly not a player that's being talked about as the best player in basketball, even in this particular season, much less one of the best of all time. He has about a 50-50 shot of, for the entirety of his career, going without a championship.
I think the one thing that is interesting about this is our definition of stars, mm-hmm. as fans or even in the media, about when we talk about which star can lead his team to a title, I think we have a very broad definition of that. Because when I walked in here, I was like, okay, well, if you told me who's a star in the NBA, I might name like 10 to 12 people. Mm-hmm. And in that simulation, you're talking about like LeBron and MJ and these like transcendent players who almost change the game in a way, as opposed to somebody like Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh, and now I'm just naming
Well, Wade at the top of his game probably was in that group too. Like he and
with
Chris
MJ
Paul,
and LeBron, or in that next level below.
No, in the MJ and LeBron level, his 2009 season, it was a really crazy year for great performances because LeBron, Chris Paul, and Dwayne Wade that one season all had seasons that rank among the top like 15 or 20 of anyone who's ever played the game in a single season.
So, Kate, you're saying that star who we talk about as stars is a bigger group than the people that are going to win the huge majority of the time. That James Harden, I think we consider a star,
right?
And he's not going to win 2/3 of the time, or 3 out of 10 times, he's not going to win a championship. So maybe once you get into that level below Harden,
yeah,
stars don't matter then in the NBA.
Yeah, I think what I'm saying is, if we want to argue the question of like, do stars matter, we need to clearly define. Like, I think we would all say, if you're talking about somebody like LeBron and Michael Jordan, do I think it matters if you have him on your team over the course of a career? Do I feel like that matters? Yes. But then if you take the next thick layer in the NBA of like top three team, you know, first team, second team, third team, do I think those players matter in terms of winning an NBA championship? That's what I think the argument then comes to, because there's transcendent players, and I would even argue at this point that maybe Steph Curry and the way his game is and what he's doing and what he forces defenses to do could be in the category of somebody who's shifting the game. And I think going forward we might see that. But do I think that if you're talking about that next layer of stars, do I think you can overcome those players with a team like the Atlanta Hawks, you know, where you're a total equation of 12 equals more than 11 plus star, if that makes sense?
Right.
I think I would argue that stars don't matter as much as we talk about them mattering, that next layer.
Yeah, it seems to be, this research seems to suggest that sort of the only way to almost guarantee or near guarantee that you're going to win at least one title is to stumble onto one of those all-time type of players like an MJ. And then in the layer below that and getting down even further and cutting into further layers, you're not guaranteed of winning. You sort of also have to have the chips fall in your favor. But to give a little perspective on basketball versus the other sports, I also did this for baseball players. So Mike Trout, of course, you know, best player in baseball. Whereas LeBron, in some of his years, he by himself could give a team of otherwise average players like as much as a 33% chance of winning the championship just by himself because he was that transcendent. Mike Trout, who has started his career with some of the best seasons in the history of baseball, and baseball's history extends even further back than basketball's, at least at the pro level, he only gives you about a 10% chance to win the title by himself. And then if you look at pitchers, so over the course of Mike Trout's career, he's going to win at least one championship about 50% of the time, which is different from someone like LeBron, who's like at 95% or so, you know, somewhere near there. And then if you look at like a Felix Hernandez or a Madison Bumgarner, a pitcher who only goes out on the mound once every 5 games, they have even less control. And so you can count on them to win a championship once in their career or more, only about 20 to 25% of the time. But there's a wrinkle to that, because that so much of winning the championship in baseball is making it to the playoffs, and that's something that pitchers uniquely don't have that much control over because of what we talked about with the games restriction, that they can only start so many games. I think what we saw with Bumgarner in particular last year sort of cuts against this, because it says that once you get into the playoffs, a guy who is a transcendent starter and can just mow people down can carry you further in the playoffs than would be suggested by just these simulated runs.
Can you quickly rank the NFL?
Oh, yeah. So hockey.
So I can mostly point at Chad,
right?
And
oh, I've got a football stat point in my back pocket.
Okay. So, like I said, we didn't do this exercise for the NFL specifically, so it's tough to say where the NFL ranks. Subjectively, I would say it ranks ahead of hockey. I would say hockey is the one where the stars have the least impact. And if you think about it, if you're just looking at a stat, there's stat that people use called goals versus threshold, which just is like goals above replacement level for, you've heard of wins above replacement for baseball. It's kind of like that for hockey, but with goals. So someone like Alexander Ovechkin, who several times has been the best player in the NHL, according to this metric, he's worth about 30 some odd goals above replacement in his best years, which translates to about 20 above an average player. But adding 20 goals to of goal differential to a team that's otherwise totally average only increases their percentage chance of winning the Stanley Cup from 1% to about 2 or 3%. Mm. So you're taking a team, you know, hockey is notoriously random. So a lot of what you do during the season with goal differential, it doesn't translate into the playoffs. So you've got that extra layer of randomness in there. So having a player like Ovechkin is not as much of a guarantee of winning a championship as having a LeBron James or even having a Mike Trout or a Madison Bumgarner. And then subjectively thinking about the NFL, Chad, you have some numbers about quarterbacks and their approximate value and how that relates to winning
the Super Bowl. So because I knew that you guys would come at me so hard once I said that NFL was the top sport where stars matter, I did a little research, and what it showed me was that I was absolutely wrong. You guys are so right. So if you according to my little thesis, mm-hmm. quarterbacks are the stars, right? Quarterbacks, even the best quarterbacks of all time, 7 out of 10 have won a championship. According to approximate value, which, Neil, you always sum up better than I do. This is a metric that...
It's a single number that represents a player's contribution to his team in a season. And, of course, since we're talking about football and we're trying to do it across not just quarterbacks but all positions, it's pretty approximate. I think you should really underline that word approximate in it. But for some of the skill positions, it does a decent job of sorting out the value that positions carry relative to each other.
So importantly, I'll list the top 10 real quick. Manning, Favre, Marino, Brady, Elway, Breeze, Tarkenton, Young.
Eli Manning.
Moon.
Eli Manning.
Montana.
Wrong man.
Sorry. So you know, mostly household names. After that top 10, the drop-off is considerable.
And this is the top 10 ever.
All time in quarterbacks. And so basically after that, it's a crapshoot, right? That even if you were a star, your value isn't going to be that high. And it's going to be total noise about whether or not you won a championship.
Well, who are some of the people in the next group?
Matt Hasselbeck, for example, right? Someone who won, who went to the Super Bowl with Seattle, but lost to Pittsburgh. He's 47th all time in approximate value. So someone we think of as sort of a good quarterback who may or may not have been a star at his time. Dante Culpepper, another sort of medium level quarterback, same down that list in the 50s. So to me, that suggests that basically the NFL, even in a small subset of players who really do have an impact on the game, even there, the stars don't matter like they do in the other sports. So if you're Mario Williams or J.J. Watt or Adrian Peterson or someone else, then you're just not going to have the effect on your team. So let's recap. Yeah, go ahead, Kate.
While Neil was talking, two things. We heard all kinds of hot takes about Ovechkin after he lost, saying that he was the only NHL two-time MVP to not advance to his conference finals, as if that was some sort of slight on his play, as if there was something intrinsically wrong with him. And it sounds like your data is showing that he has, what, like a 1% might make his team 1% more likely to win?
Right, yeah, and the really interesting thing about
hockey... So we can take that hot take down.
We can consider it taken down. The most valuable players each year, according to the metric that I was looking at, tend to be goalies, actually. They tend to be the ones that have like the biggest impact because they're the ones directly responsible for stopping the puck, and so having a great goalie can be a huge edge to you. But even that comes with a caveat because some of the research that I've done and a lot of other people in hockey have done showed that very little of that performance tends to carry over into the playoffs, for one, and then also into subsequent seasons. So goalies are very random. So the great irony is the players that seem to be the most valuable in hockey actually have the least persistent ability to carry it over into the future, and then the players that are sort of more reliable don't make as much of a dent in the first place, like the skaters like Ovechkin.
So let's recap, and then I want to talk about the metrics of what should matter in the first place. So what we know is NBA, top of the heap, and even then, the star matters when you're super good, and when you're not super good, matters perhaps less than we might expect. And then all the other sports fall in order: baseball, then football, then hockey is our current hypothesis. What's matter though? What is it that matters? Is it championships? Is it a win-loss record during the season? Is it something like a power ranking, ELO rating? What is it that we should be evaluating these players on? Because, Kay, as you hinted with the hot take about Ovechkin that you just mentioned, championships are the end-all be-all of a player's legacy. What we talk about on this podcast all the time is that a player's legacy is defined in a small sample by definition, by nature. It happens in a single moment when Ray Allen takes that three-pointer falling out of bounds against the Spurs, and that's just one shot of thousands that he takes, and the percentage that goes in or not is whatever
it is,
42, and that's the difference in his legacy. Perhaps Ray Allen has a bigger one, obviously, but do stars matter to win championships? Do stars matter for a team to play well? Like, what is it that we should be evaluating them on?
Well, it seems like, at least in the context of this study, I was trying to figure out which players and which sports stars put you in a position to be in the conversation for the championship. So I think, you know, stuff can happen no matter what you try to do, and the best laid plans can go awry in the playoffs, especially in some of the sports like hockey and baseball in particular, where it's an extremely small sample compared to the season that led up to it, and the bounce of a puck here or there can knock you out of the playoffs. So being a part of that conversation and just giving yourself a chance year after year after year, that seems to be the advantage that the best players in the NBA have over other sports. And I think a lot of it also comes down to, like you mentioned, usage rate, the ability to funnel the flow of play through your best players. That's something that you don't have in baseball by any means. Barry Bonds can only bat once every nine times, once every time through the order. And whereas LeBron James can touch the ball, you know, every possession, and he can end, one out of every three possessions for your team, that makes a huge difference. And like you said about ice time, Kate, where hockey players, they may have more of an impact for every second that they're on the ice than one of the best baseball players does proportionately. But they take shifts, and they're only on the ice for 20 to 25 minutes if you're a star forward. And that really limits their ability to make a difference.
I feel like, just because we're talking now about the fact that maybe stars can't impact championships the way we think of them, I still think championships in how we want to, as fans, celebrate and talk about sports is a good measuring tool, if that makes sense. I mean,
so then is Tony Parker better than Steph Curry?
Right, that's where I guess I don't want to use it as like who's better than who, but I think it's a really good tool to talk about these intangibles that we like to talk about. Like, is Ray Allen somehow more something about him intrinsically and his nature of being able to shoot under pressure? Does that make him a better like all-time player than another shooter of his caliber because he had those? I think those are things as fans that you don't want to take away ever in terms of measuring championships as the ultimate goal. Because if you take that away, then we don't really have any sort of like pot at the end of the rainbow.
Why are we watching the? Why are we spending every night for the last 2 months
right.
watching the NBA playoffs?
I mean, I think it's always helpful as a fan to be like, well, look, we didn't talk about did you peak at the right time, and did you peak at the right time when another team wasn't peaking at the same time? Like, you can talk about Charles Barkley peaking in '93 with the Suns, and he just happened to run into the Bulls and Jordan, and they lost 4-2. Versus the very next year, you have Olajuwon and the Rockets peaking, and Jordan's playing baseball. And how does that matter for those people's legacy? I think if you have all the information, you can have really good conversations and look at sports in a new way. But I do love having titles and championships as kind of like this golden, you know, medal you're chasing for.
Yeah, and there's a saying in even sabermetrics where they say flags fly forever. And it really means like winning a championship, even though we're acknowledging more and more with research that there's a role that luck plays, at the end of the day, winning the ring is what we're all in this for, and it's the goal that every team has.
That's what I'm in it
season.
For.
That's right.
Winning Hot Takedown's going to win some rings.
We're going to win titles.
I want a Hot Takedown pennant, guys.
If Let's we don't, we're happening. Obviously flawed in some way if we don't win all those championships. Right.
No matter how good we are in the regular season, if we don't have that flag flying. Then this
something's
is all
missing.
Yeah. Okay, guys, let's leave it there. I think we've solved this for all time. I'm sure we won't have to
put it in the book
again a year from now. And welcome the one, the only Allison McCannon for our significant digit. Allison, hello, as always.
Hey, Chad.
What do you have today?
All right. I know this has been a very tennis-heavy episode, but this one was too good to pass up. So this week's significant digit is 2, which is the number of underhanded serves that French player Virginie Rosano hit during her first round win. Yes, win at the French Open yesterday. And I guess her serve had been pretty erratic in the first set, and her double fault count was like almost up to double digits. And so she decided to go for the very unprecedented underhand serve. She ended up losing the point, but that didn't deter her from trying it again in the third set, on match point, no less. And she ended up double faulting. But I just was like...
So what does it look like?
It's like a like you're
it's like you drop kind of drop and hit the ball as opposed to throwing it up.
But like
imagine happening in Florida gated community.
In professional, isn't this how everybody learns to play tennis?
I think it is.
Right.
I think it is.
Okay,
but in professional tennis, it almost looks like she was like, "Oh, here's the ball back." It's like going so slow.
Yeah, I was curious. What was it clocked at? What was the speed? Or could they even measure the speed?
Oh, I'm sure. But like the announcer like audibly gasps on the thing, being like, "She's done it again!" Like, was like people were appalled and were saying like, if she wasn't French, like probably she would have gotten booed. Like, it's very bad form, I guess, to do.
Except if you're injured, because I have seen players if they're battling a shoulder injury, they'll drop a couple underhand serves.
So here's the thing, though. I think every profession should have their own underhand serve that's welcomed and embraced. So if I were in a writing or an editing sort of pickle, right, and I didn't want to figure out the perfect transition between paragraphs, I should be able to just toss the next sentence in,
drop
right?
in without, an underhand serve there.
Or just be like, or, I mean, plenty of writers say, okay, here's what I was telling you about, and here's what I'm going to tell you about now. Sometimes you just need an underhand serve in whatever you do to get you going.
True. I mean, that's why I'm always like, however, that's my underhand serve in transitions. Yeah. However, yeah. comma.
Yeah. Allison, what's an underhand serve in charts and interactive graphics?
Oh.
Is there one?
probably just like a bar chart.
A bar chart. Like, the underhand serve of all.
But I will say, in her defense, after the game, they interviewed her, like, what were you thinking? You did this twice. And she was like, oh, I like to surprise my adversary sometimes with the underhand serve. And I thought that was particularly relevant given our John Nash obituary, where he talks about this sort of mixed strategy.
On game theory.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so...
Right, if you're always waiting for the super hard serve, it makes me think of the
Ephus pitch. I was
going to
go
baseball.
There too, Neil.
Exactly. Orlando Hernandez, among others, used to uncork this incredibly slow softball-esque pitch that would cross the plate at a very slow rate. And a lot of batters would be caught off guard by it and not know what to do with it. Except I remember A-Rod crushing it. He threw it on back-to-back pitches. And on the first one, A-Rod took it and processed it and tried to kind of figure out what was going on. And then the second one, he crushed it like 400 feet into the stand. So it doesn't always work.
A-Rod's not
right.
a centaur.
And
he's
like,
a cyborg.
With serving, if you want to catch him off guard, you should keep your motion the same and then just take a lot
exactly.
of velocity off it. Because she's dropping it, and, like, you can see it. The changeup in baseball is like the legitimate changeup. Like your form should be the same until the moment the pitch is released. That's a little different. And
so
I'm not totally buying her argument.
The
is what I'm saying.
Serve in tennis. I mean, they already have slower serves, but what if we really slowed it down overhand? Kate, you just found your new career, tennis coach. I think
Andy Murray's going to need a new one soon because. Maresmo's going. She's going away for a few months. Did we not know this?
No.
Am I like a tennis
aficionado?
News?
Yeah, you're breaking tennis news, or no? This
no,
is
this
just,
is common
this
knowledge.
Is well okay.
Yes. Yeah, but I can step in for her.
Great. So, Allison, thanks for bringing your own underhand serves. Those are some overhand significant digits. I think those are blazing
ace.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing to Hot Takedown as always.
Thanks for having me.
So that'll do it for this week's show. You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. And while you're there, be sure to review and rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Thank you, Chad.
I'm Chad McMatlin. Thanks for listening.